Okay, well, I guess we can go ahead and get started. My name is Cheryl May, and this session is the practice of science and technology. Since we'll be working together in the next hour, I do like to give you something about my context, the context that I came out of. If you were in the last session, I should say right away that I'm a woman, and so that means something about my communication. other things to tell you about, I am a biochemist by training. I teach chemistry now at Catholic University, so that means I teach science majors. I also teach nursing majors, and I do teach non-science majors. And I've also taught traditional, non-traditional students. So I've got these different cultures that I communicate in as a science educator. I think another important thing to know about me is that at the moment I'm the director of the core curriculum at Capital, so I'm very interested in the intersection between science and humanities, and I'm always looking for ways in which we can talk together, the scientific and humanities community. And then finally, maybe another important thing for you to know is that I am a member of the steering committee of the ELCA Work Group on Science and Technology. So that there is a group in the ELCA who are working on issues at the boundaries of science and faith. And so I just want to hold that up to you. I have really two goals for us today. The first one, I'd really like to spend some time reflecting on the role of science and technology in society. And I think it's important not only to think about that from today's perspective, but we also need to compare it to where we've been so that we can see the changes, and then think for some time about where this current road that we're on is going to lead to in the future. And what I'd like to do then after that is really offer a framework for thinking about science and technology in society that really allows everyone to participate in discussions about science and technology. I think as we talk about science and technology, what we're going to find is there are some people who can participate in that discussion and many people who are not allowed to participate. And what we need to find is ways in which we can bridge some gaps and really all have a chance to participate. My rationale, of course, is if we're going to have a whole new world, we really need some new ways or different ways of thinking. We really need to extend ourselves from where we are into new directions. And so that's what I hope this framework will do for us, is offer us a way to move forward. I realize that the audience here at Holden is pretty articulate and what have you already, so there's not much education that I think I need to do to start with. But what I would like for us to do is to take some time to really paint a picture about science and technology in society. I think we can all work on that together. And so where I would like to start is in the present. I think there's no way we can deny that we live in a scientific technological world. Even here at Holden, science and technology is around us. We've got the mine over there. We hear about the hydroelectric generation of power here, etc. So even at Holden, we cannot get away from science and technology. So what I would like for us to do in the next few minutes is to paint kind of a word picture of science and technology in society. And I think we can do that if we look at three areas. So if we look in the area of health, leisure, and work, what is there about these areas that tells us that we live in a scientific, technological world? Maybe there's enough of this now that we could maybe divide in two and just take some time to think about what are the artifacts, how do we know that we live in a scientific, technological world in these three areas? So let's just take maybe 3 or 4 minutes to see what you can come up with. Kind of paint a picture of health, leisure, and work that tells you that science and technology is pervasive.
How many in the group?
Let me break in for just a moment. I think now you've brought to the front here what science and technology has done in the present. Let's ask our chronologically gifted friends here and take us back into the past, and maybe go back far as 40 or 50 years ago, and remind us.
I like that.
Isn't that nice? Are you going to patent that one? Like, you have that on your own. I actually heard it from somebody else. I can't take the credit for that. But I think it's useful to get a sense of how it was, that I think too often we forget how it was. So let's take a few minutes now to recreate how things were in the areas of health, leisure, work. Pick any time frame. So take a few minutes to talk that over. Okay, I'm going to break in at this point. I'm sure we could go on another hour just reflecting on this very topic. I'd like to break in. I must say, I noticed right off that you're a very sophisticated audience. When I do this with the sophomores that I encounter at Capital University, what happens at this point is everyone is really glad that they live in this highly scientific, technological world. We've named all the different possible ways you can use a computer. Gee, isn't life wonderful? And what I generally have to do with them at that point is to say, okay, let's stop and take a look at where we are really. And I have to really work hard to point out to them that they're also this kind of ambivalent kind of risk side to the whole scientific technological enterprise. I don't think I need to do that with you. I mean, it sounds to me like in many of your discussions you were going, on the one hand we have this, but on the other hand we have this. I would like to ask you, when you were talking about the scientific technological world, if you had to balance how often you talked about benefits and how often you talked about risks, what did you notice in your talk? Did risks come up? Did the downside of science and technology come up? Did it come up over here, Al?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's very interesting that it doesn't with our young people. And
does
in fact,
it does not.
And I found really the only way that I could get them to really face the risk was I asked them to do the following project. I said, I want you to go find the worst case in the last 60 years of an abuse of science and technology. And I want you to bring it back to the class and present it to your classmates. And only then did they start to really make it their own and really start to feel really the horror in the abuse of science and technology. One young man, a history major, brought in a map of Columbus where he'd made the radii of what would happen at various locations had the atomic bomb dropped on Columbus. So he really made it, you know, he brought it home to his own personal life. At that point, then, our discussion could go on and we could look at the issues. But up until that point, it was, isn't science and technology wonderful, period. Mm-hmm. I don't think we need to do that. I think you're all really sophisticated about that. Two things that I'd like to point out in your discussion, and something that I always have to point out to the young people, is how is our notion of progress tied into the scientific technological enterprise? That I think, you know, we talk about progress as being, at least for most people, bigger, better, faster, and of course it's science and technology that really has promoted that idea. So I think we also we need to think now about what the definition of progress is and how what definitions of progress we want to hold and how we want science and technology to interface with those definitions. Another thing that I notice when this subject comes up is that young people often feel as if science and technology offers a solution to every single problem. And also we can say that about certainly about other people, adults as well, chronologically gifted people as well too. I know that the editor of Science Magazine, I follow the area of genetics, and I'm going to be talking about that next week, but the editor of Science Magazine has held up the notion that gene therapy will solve social problems. And so here we see an example where science and technology is offering to us solutions for everything, every kind of problem. So I think we've got kind of these kind of three things, this progress problem, this problem of science offering solutions to everything, plus this tension that we feel. On the one hand, we love our computers, but on the other hand, sometimes we feel disconnected from our work and so on because of the technology. So what are we going to do with this tension? Clearly, we can't go back to the garden, even though it seems as if many people here in Holden are we'll be trying to aim for that. It's not possible to go back to the garden. It really isn't. So what we need to figure out is a way that we can address this tension and the ambivalence that we have about all this. And I think where I would like to start then is to ask the question, what is your definition of science and technology in your discussion?
Were we supposed to define it?
No. I think now that we've done some exploration, let's go back and look in on our exploration and see what we can find. I think one definition that, an easy definition to take would be science and technology is what scientists and technologists do. Right? That would be an easy definition. And I think that's a common definition. I think there's some problems with that definition. First of all, you have to ask yourself, well, who are the scientists? And it turns out if you ask third graders all the way up onto adults to draw a picture of a scientist, what do you get?
A male.
Glasses.
Coat.
A lab coat.
Test tubes.
Fuming sometimes.
Pocket full of pens.
No expression on his face.
No expression, all right. Kind of objective.
Behind a mask.
Behind a mask, goggles maybe.
And a beard.
And a beard. Often bald.
Uh-huh.
Often bald, all right. So if we take that to be our scientist, right away we can see some problems with defining science as what scientists do, because what that tells us is there's only one kind of scientist, all right, and so there's only one voice through which science speaks. And the fact of the matter is that there is controversy in science, that there are different voices. Not all scientists feel the same way about problems and things like that in science. So by defining science as what scientists do, if we have only one picture of scientists, we are hearing only one voice. And I think right away there's a problem with that.
Well, the commercial says making things better through chemistry.
Right. One voice, right? Right. So even if we now posit that there are different scientists, all right, I think what many of us hope, and certainly what I've tried to hang on to as being in this world of science myself, is that there are some scientists out there who are expressing their voice and their concern, and what we all as a society need to do is count on those people to kind of make sure that the other scientists don't go off and do really horrible things, right? I think there's a problem with that, and that is the socialization pressure in science, particularly in science education, is so strong that it's really hard to maintain really any sense of questioning the authority of science, particularly as you're developing as a young person. So what we need then is a way in which all of us can participate in discussions about science, that we can't just leave these discussions up to the scientists, even though we tend to think they're the experts, and so they will know best about how to use what they've created. And so I would like to offer then for you a way to think about science in which now we can all participate. You don't have to be an expert, you don't have to be a scientist in order to talk about science and technology, as you've all really illustrated here this morning. And that is, I think we need to move to a definition more like this, that science and technology, we really need to think of as science and technology practice. So let's move away from the definition of science is what scientists do and move towards a more practice definition. What I'm doing is I'm extending the work of Arnold Pacey, who defines technology as technology practice, and I'm putting in science as part of this definition. And the analogy would be to medicine. We talk about medical science. So what would that mean to you, medical science? The facts, knowing the anatomy, knowing how the heart works, and so on. And then we talk about medical practice. What does that mean?
What happens in the office?
What happens in the office?
In the lab.
In the lab.
Surgery.
What happens in the operating room?
Surgery.
Doctors, nurses, technicians, cleaning staff, in hospitals. It also includes insurance, all right? The insurance enterprise. So by moving towards a practice definition, we're looking at a much broader picture here, and I think we can do the same thing with science and technology. So what does science and technology practice mean? How are you going to define that? Arnold Pacey defines this practice notion as the web of human activity surrounding science and technology. All right. So now we're bringing in not only the scientists with the great ideas, the theories, but we're talking about the labs, the lab equipment, the organization of the lab, who pays for the research, how people feel about science, what are the values inherent in science, and things like that. So the web of human activity now allows us to bring in much more into thinking about science and technology. Well, the web of human activity, that's kind of an amorphous thing, so how are we going to really focus this definition? We can do that by bringing out these three aspects of the practice. So if you're talking about the web of human activity, what you're talking about are technical, cultural, and organizational aspects. Let me just define these for you. Technical would be what you generally think about science and technology. The facts, the theories, the knowledge. Technology would be the artifacts, and so on. So really the technical part of this definition would be then what you normally think about as science and technology. Let me skip down to organizational aspects. That would be who pays for the research, how is the work organized, who's actually doing the work. You'd be surprised to learn that most named scientists are not actually at the bench themselves carrying out the experiments. They're the ones with the ideas who are managing the work, and so on. Organizational aspects, what else besides who pays? Where do scientists do their work? Right. Where do they buy their test tubes? Who makes their test tubes? Right. So there's much more involved when you move to this kind of definition. And then finally, I think The one where everyone can participate would be in the cultural aspect of science and technology practice, where we're thinking about the values, the feelings that we have about science and technology. We could even take it as a literal term, cultural. What's science like in the United States compared to Canada, Mexico, and so on. So really cultural allows, I think, a place where everyone can talk about these things.
Yeah. Where does the marketplace come in, the consumption of technology? Is that cultural or organizational?
Yeah, it's probably fuzzy. I mean, if you're talking about who's doing the selling, it would be the organizational aspects. Mm-hmm. Who's doing the buying, I think, would come okay. into the cultural aspects.
So we as consumers of technology have a right to participate.
I would think so, wouldn't you?
And using, you know, talking about the healthcare or medicine, I mean, you were using that, I think, as sort of a paradigm or something.
Right.
Well, where do you put the pharmaceutical industry?
Well, certainly within the industry, there would be the technical aspects of what's the composition of a certain drug. The organizational aspects of the industry would be, you know, who funds the pharmaceutical industry, how is the work organized, that kind of thing. You could also really do the practice of the pharmaceutical industry itself. This is, I think, the notion of practice is something that you can apply to many things. And the only thing I'm doing really is applying it to science and technology, because I find that we have a very limited notion about what science and technology is. And we always end up wanting to leave it up to the experts. Mm-hmm. I should say that this definition really fits into a burgeoning academic discipline called the science-technology society discipline. I would say this is about a 20-year-old movement or so, where now we've got undergraduate degrees and a few graduate degrees offered in this area of science and technology practice. That if you find yourself, like I was talking to a young woman who's on staff here, that she's really not too pleased having completed her undergraduate degree in science. She's not really pleased with the enterprise. Well, what could she do now? At this point, she could move into one of these other more applied areas and really help broaden our definition of science and technology practice.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is it essential at this stage to define the differences between science and technology, or is that not really?
Well, I think we could spend time doing that because there are differences. But they're also very closely connected at this point in our history,
yeah.
I think. So much so, in fact, that at my university, we don't talk about science and technology. We talk about sci-tech.
Mm-hmm.
But we talk about it now as one discipline.
Not one word.
Because they're all connected.
So
yeah.
I'd like to bring up something here as you go. Because
sure.
In the cultural, as we've gone along, and that, if we're discussing, it's almost as if there's a monster out here that's coming at us. And I worked for years in research and development, teaching in agriculture. And in one sense, it maybe is to people that are looking at it. In the other sense, this is composed of human beings. And all these, in every individual, every scientist that goes to the lab bench or goes here or goes there, or he's maybe in sales, that individual has a conscience or whatever. It has some balance of in his mind of what their own personal journey is.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to me that we have to give scientists as much credit for having the ability to do a personal journey as let's say a person is that knows religions or in the clergy. Okay. So that's what, that seems to me would be a big issue. Maybe you're going to be talking about that during the week. In other words, what is the personal journey
uh-huh.
that a scientist does?
Uh-huh.
And is it any different than a person that writes books or acts
uh-huh.
in the movies? It's still a personal journey.
Yeah, I guess I would want to argue that the socialization pressure in science...
I know you implied that before.
...is one that really tries to homogenize that personal journey.
Okay.
You know, So what's happening is that scientists are disconnected from their work, and that if we thought of science as a practice and we felt connected to our work, picking up our test tube and reminding ourselves that someone made that test tube, or thinking about the results of an experiment and asking ourselves, you know, where is it going to end up down the road, that I think what's happened with the socialization pressure is that scientists are very disconnected from what happens to their work after it leaves their bench.
Well,
in my experience.
There was an illustration the other night. The student, or the young man, first asked Elizabeth about if she felt comfortable
right.
buying a camera.
Right.
And She has to decide that, just like I have to decide it, and that individual has to decide it. And we must, I think we have to give credit to every person that they should be able to do a personal journey so that they can justify whether they buy a camera or not.
Yeah. I'm not trying to take anything away from scientists, because we still need, you know, they still have a voice here. They're really the technical experts. But what I'm trying to suggest is that we all need to engage in the dialogue about science and technology. If we leave it just up to scientists, I mean, they've got a particular perspective, that we need these varying perspectives. Yeah.
It might be helpful, though, to add personal
as
a category, even if it means the erasing of personal difference, using the category there analytically could display.
That's right. I felt there was spiritual or something.
What about if we bring it under into cultural, because that would that's a much more personal kind of category.
That bifurcates person and organization. If you just subsume it under
Good. Anybody else want to respond?
Well, I just wanted to humanize the scientist a little bit more, because in the group that I worked at, it turns out that only one idea out of 500 turned out to be good, you know, by somebody's standard. Right? The scientist faces defeat every time he goes into the laboratory and every time he starts to think about this thing. So you have to give him credit for being in there enough, either they're stupid or that something else is driving it. But they face defeat constantly.
Well, could that be some of what the rationale is by the scientist's point of view, of them disconnecting themselves from what they do? Because if they face defeat time and time again, and if they were invested and if they put themselves in that work, then what they saw was constant defeat, and that could be very personally. So by separating yourself from that, I am not my work, and so what I do is not me, and therefore if this is a failure and flops, I'm okay.
Yeah.
This may not be a direction you want us to go, Cheryl, but I can confirm that by personal experience of a scientist who told me that when he does not get the answer he is looking for in his lab, he tries to devise his questions and he gets an answer will give him results. Because the stockholders want results, right? It's profit, R&D stock. So if he doesn't get the answer he wants, then he will reframe the question so he does get a successful answer. So that the whole process for him at least will avoid failure. And failure is not just a metaphysical category of psychological one, it's an economic one involving his job, his future, his children's inheritance, and the success of the operation. We don't, in English departments, we don't have people hearing over our shoulders if we can get results.
Is
it
commercial?
Yeah.
Do you have a comment?
Yeah. Where do you give us guidance for the dilemma we're in, that science requires requires specialization, and we need generalization along with it. It also requires deregulation, freedom, and yet we need some limitations, because this thing can be very dangerous.
I guess what I'm trying to suggest is that we need to put science back into the culture and not separate it from something out over here. But also to recognize, and I think some of the things that you're bringing up here is to recognize that the culture gives expectations to the scientists, that we expect scientists to do certain things, and so that's why when that failure is there, it's not only an economic failure, but it's often a personal failure that I'm not smart enough or something like that. But it also works the other way, that science puts expectations on us as well, and that I think the both of those situations create problems. So what we have to do is bring it back into our lives. And I think the way we do that is to begin to think about science in a much different way. Yeah.
Well, maybe it's helpful to think again about the medical field. Because I think doctors are so frequently criticized as being gods, but they're only gods because we have put them there as gods. And when I decide that I'm going to accept responsibility for my health, my body, my spirit, and approach a doctor in that fashion, he won't be there, or she won't be there. And so we've done it. I mean, and how you know, I mean, I'm just one person, and there does have to be some way to
Yeah. Well, building on that, the one aspect of the cultural, as you were just illustrating the cultural part, is that you didn't bring in the historical aspect, and I'm sure that you want to include that.
Right, right.
And I don't think we can get back to the garden, as you quite rightly point out, but I do think that if we learn the path from the garden, we can perhaps recover one of the forks in the road, and then we can begin to reconstruct the medical field, for example. So we begin to say, right, if the ideology of the Enlightenment isn't correct, that there is just a certain body, and that's what science is all about, then and we recover spirit, then we can begin to say, well, who takes responsibility for spirit then? And you see, then we begin to move in a different direction. So I, as a historian, I think that history is quite vital in science.
And I would say to you, in science education, we do no history, we do no philosophy, we just pour out the facts is what we do. And so again, by bringing this back, by bringing science back into culture and looking at it as an institution, I think we can begin to put history and philosophy back into the enterprise. And we don't have that at all. Maybe another way to think about this is think about your own experience in science education, whatever classes you were in. How often did you talk about the values associated with science? How often did you talk about the benefits and risks in your science classes? Right?
You mean in science education you don't go back and talk about some of the mileposts of discovery?
It's not happening anymore. It's in chapter one of the chemistry book, but we don't have time anymore.
Unless you're in the humanities,
then we really are
you're
in trouble.
Looking at it from the outside into the
right.
science.
Mm-hmm. The humanities.
No, but
some
you see,
humanities.
You see, but the history which is given is ideal. Is all history is ideological, but the ideology is never recognized. That is to say, that history is sort of a the history of science is kind of a progress from glory to glory. And the greatest glory is, of course, where we are now. So that there's a kind of, I mean, when I was taught the history of science, it was this fairly arrogant kind of history, and one which is caught up in a metaphor of progress. Now I think we need to define what exactly progress is. What would be progress in science? And there are other metaphors, like we were talking in a private conversation about Kuhn's theory, that there isn't progress. There's just sort of one community battering against another community, and there's revolutions. Right? There's new paradigms of looking at things. And I'm not wanting to necessarily promote that here, but I'm just saying that this whole notion of progress is something.
So if you were pushing for more history of science, you have to be careful not just to push for progressive history.
Yeah, right.
Is that
or just a Western history?
Yeah.
Is the progress that you visualize in science from glory to glory, is that characteristic only of science, or would it be? Okay.
I would say that's characteristic of All of this, I believe, is kind of a product of the Enlightenment. That is to say, not only in terms of the sciences, but in terms of the humanities as well. The way history has been traditionally taught, right? Like we move on from the age of superstition to the age of reason.
You had a comment, yeah.
Well, mention a couple of things in the area of organization. Our university runs off grants, research grants. Nobody says, I think I'm going to discover something, but what will it sell, and if I can sell it. We have a team of 50 researchers which will be leaving our university, the University of Houston, because the package is moved down there and is funded down there now through organizations. So it's heavily endowed that way. That's the determination. And it's really not to the point of whether I'm successful, whether I fail or I don't fail. Some avenues have to be checked out to see if they're not going to fail or if they will fail. And so some people are given those assignments pointed toward failure.
Uh-huh.
And they don't know that. Just like they don't know whether they're on a 10-year track when they're hired or not. People play let's pretend, let's lie, and say, oh, yes, you're there. And then they discover 4 years later, no, that you're not on a 10-year track. You got slot A, not slot B. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that. The other piece of it is how the organization handles themselves. Second piece of it is that the organization also protects itself. I serve on institutional review boards for human subjects in all different areas. There's three different areas there. That's not for the human subjects to protect them. Really, you know, that's what we say. It's so that the university doesn't get sued.
Right.
That's the whole process of this thing. And so the organization really, to me, is the driving force in science and technology, determining a lot. So a science, a person in science is much more the tail, the tip of the tail, which gets wagged.
How often do you think they feel like they're the tip of the tail?
A lot.
Do you think so?
Yeah, just like we were talking earlier this morning in the choices people make in value things in the parable study. Number of people I know who've chosen to be an associate professor is their whole career because they refuse to be egocentric maniacs who become a professor. In our university, that's what you really have to be, and they will not become that because they will not lose their humanness. They choose not to do that.
And because we're living from glory to glory, of course, we don't hear about those kinds of
things. We have higher and higher glories.
Right.
I mean, to get a bigger lab and more people is higher prestige.
Right. And then what happens, of course, is the young people, they don't hear about the associate professors. What they see is, you know, I'm going to enter graduate school and get myself a Nobel Prize.
I'm going to get a job.
Yeah.
I don't care about the company that can build bombs for Bangladesh.
Right.
Oh, I have a job.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Is there such a thing as pure scientific research?
I mean, that's a very good question. In fact, it's one that we're going to explore this week. Notion of purity and maybe objectivity, those kinds of questions.
This may say to Harry how old I am, but it seems to me so tragic that 40 years ago we had theologians who were giving some sense of direction to society, Reinhold Niebuhr and others, and now I'm not aware of it.
Well, Douglas John Hall would be an example trying to reflect on the theological response to technology in North America.
And how many of us have heard of Douglas John Hall?
That's my question.
Yeah.
How pervasive is his information to people who can do something about it?
There are places, though, in medical schools, like the University of Washington has a piece of it, leading guest lectures of our university on personal ethics, personal values, personal ethics that help tie things together. Is a need, but it's sort of an outside lecture that's brought in. If they bring an ethicist in, this is usually a person who cannot communicate with other human beings.
And then I would add to that.
Person who can. It's a rare one who can. They don't stay around very long. They get hired by somebody who says, oh, this person can talk to people.
And what I would add to that, of course, is in the science curriculum for our graduate students who go on to become professors, they never have an ethics course.
Yeah.
They may be giving doctors and lawyers and business people ethics courses, but we don't have them in science.
The vet school does.
The vet school does.
Medicine, pharmacy, engineering does. But it's short-term guest lectures. I give a lecture on how to have a successful marriage to engineers. You know, I just roll up my pants legs and I go into the class. They don't want to hear the truth. They want to hear something else.
Yeah.
Is engineering, since you mentioned, does that fall under technology?
Yeah, definitely applied science.
Is it the same? I mean, it seems like we've been talking a lot about science and scientists and engineers. I have never looked at as being scientists.
I think they come under the technology. But I think even in their training, of course, they never ask questions about value, I don't think. They don't ask too many questions about values associated.
They just want to design the first 200.
Get the biggest, building. The best building or what have you, road or what have you. Progress. Did you want to
make... We had one social scientist who was on the campus in September. I did not hear it. I didn't hear about it later. And his was that we can solve the problem of racism in the United States within three generations. Of course, the point was by proper handling the genes will all be one color. So problem would be hair color. He says hair color is so indiscriminate. And he was really serious.
They're very serious. Well, it turns out that you're raising some issues that we're going to deal with throughout the week. Tomorrow, what I'd like to talk about is some philosophy of science. So if you're interested in philosophy of science, I'd like to look at something about the nature of scientific knowledge, because I think if we're all going to participate, and then we have ways to participate, but if we're all going to participate, we need to understand something about the fundamental nature of scientific knowledge. And so that's what I would like to offer to you tomorrow. I'd like to thank you all for your participation. It's really an enjoyable session. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl.